Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon. Welcome along to this week's edition of Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, and this is the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate, conversations that matter every single week. And if you're new to the programme, can I encourage you to check out our vast back catalogue of shows via the podcast, which can be accessed from our website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. There you'll find lots of other resources, features, video, and of course, the Unbelievable book as well, explaining why, after 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian, plus links to our brand new project coming next week. And since we put out a teaser promo video about a week and a half ago, we've had an enormous response to it already. In fact, over 2,000 of you have signed up for our special Unbelievable newsletter update, which will keep you informed about the big conversation, as well as all the other activities that Unbelievable brings you. If you'd like to join that, if you want to go and watch the teaser promo, kind of encourage you to go to our website for that special series at thebigconversation.show. Watch the video, sign up to the newsletter, and you'll be the very first to be able to watch, engage, and download those special programs. Thebigconversation.show is the website you're looking for, and the first edition of the series airs next week on this program as Jordan B. Peterson faces off against Susan Blackmore, asking, do we need God to make sense of life? But you really want to watch these videos as well that we're producing around this, so do make sure to sign up there, and we'll make sure to keep you informed about the big conversation as this special series continues. I'm looking forward to reading some of your feedback towards the end of today's program and meeting some unbelievable listeners who were over in the UK recently. Right now, though, it's time to get into today's edition of the program. You're unbelievable. Well, welcome along to today's edition of the show, where we're asking, where did the laws of nature come from? My guests today are Hugh Ross and Peter Atkins. Hugh Ross is an astrophysicist and president of Reasons to Believe, a science and faith research organisation. His book, The Creator and the Cosmos, is now in its fourth edition and aims to show why the latest advances in scientific discovery support the case for a creator and the truth of Christianity. You can find out more about Hugh and Reasons to Believe at their website, reasons.org. Peter Atkins is former professor of physical chemistry at the University of Oxford. He's well known as an atheist voice in the science and faith debate. And his latest book, Conjuring the Universe, aims to show that the origins of the laws of nature are perfectly explicable without any need for God. And you can find out more about his book at the OUP website, Oxford University Press. Thank you, Hugh and Peter, for joining me on today's programme.
You're welcome.
Great to have you with us. Just a little introduction to you both and a brief explanation about the books that you're both here to talk about. Hugh, this is actually the Creator and the Cosmos has been around some time. This is its fourth edition. Why do you keep updating it?
Well, because of what you see in Psalms and Job, that the more you learn about nature, the more evidence you'll see for the supernatural handiwork of God. And so we're committed to demonstrate that, that indeed the more we astronomers learn, the stronger the evidence becomes for the Creator God of the Bible.
Now, we don't have time for the long version, but give us a potted history of how you came to faith, because it was really through your study of the universe and astrophysics, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Canada. I was not raised in a Christian home, didn't know any Christians, but it was through my astronomy that I realized the universe had a beginning, and I said, if there's a beginning, there must be a beginner, and I began to search for that beginner, first in philosophy, then through the Hindu Vedas, and looked at other holy books like the Quran, Buddhist commentaries, and finally picked up a Bible, and I spent 18 months going through it, trying to find a provable scientific error or contradiction, discovered that it actually gave all the elements of Big Bang cosmology. That really impressed me, the fact that it got all the science right, And so I eventually signed my name in the back of a Gideon Bible, giving my life to Jesus Christ.
That obviously took you in the direction eventually of, alongside the research you were doing as a physicist and astrophysicist, to actually founding Reasons to Believe. And essentially, you often speak of Reasons to Believe as seeing that there are two books that we read from. Do you want to explain?
Yeah, the Book of Nature and the Book of Scripture, and how God designed the Book of Nature to expose his attributes and get us to the Book of Scripture. And so, yeah, ours is a two books organization. Mm-hmm. And just saying, the more we learn about both, the more compatibility we find between both.
And when it comes to some of the big advances that we've seen in the last half a century in terms of astrophysics and the origin of the universe, the nature of the fine-tuning of the universe and so on, are these some of the key things that you bring out in Creator and the Cosmos?
Well, the fourth edition's got 80 pages of new content, and that's because we have so much more fine-tuning evidence than we had, say, 15 years ago. And so I bring out that new fine-tuning evidence, the fact that we have a much stronger case for Big Bang cosmology than we had 15 years ago. So I talk about that, and also address several of the atheist challenges to the Big Bang creation model and how to respond to those.
Okay. Well, we've got one of those challenges right here.
Right.
Peter Atkins, it's great to have you back on the program. Now, you're a professor of physical chemistry by background, but you've chosen to sort of expand in some ways in this new book into the area of the physics of the universe and so on. Do you find that all of these disciplines tend to merge into one another at some level?
Well, that's the whole point of science. It's not a series of islands of isolated activity. It really is a reticulation of ideas, which, depending where they come from, meld together, and they're not in conflict. They're not like Christianity and Islam, where which are in conflict, where they mingle. But ideas from astronomy and biology actually are mutually supportive, and that's really one of the great strengths of science.
And I suppose back in the day, whereas today scientists tend to focus very exclusively on a very tight niche, The natural sciences were really quite broad. Scientists were scientists across the board, in a sense.
When I was active as a scientist, then, of course, I had to specialise.
Yes.
Everyone does. But I think now that I'm ancient, I can stand back and look at the whole tapestry of science.
Yes.
And it is such a glorious tapestry that I just like to share it with everyone, even people who are not articulate in the sciences. They should see the insights that science has provided.
We've heard Hugh's story of how he came to faith, in part through what he saw as the evidence for God in the universe. Have you always seen yourself as an atheist, or was there any journey towards that sort of particular view?
Well, one was brought up as an unthinking child in the Church of England, and as soon as I went to college and realised that one could have ideas of one's own, then I shed the religious carapace that had been pressed on me and started to look at the world through a scientist's eyes, and found that was wonderfully invigorating.
And with the new book then, just to give us a sense of what you're doing with the book, because at the very outset you do make it clear that if God has ever been posited as an explanation for the universe, you're very much intent on showing why that really is not necessary. And, in fact, that we can speak of a universe that came from nothing.
Well, I think the principal idea is that we scientists are hewers of simplicity from complexity, that we see this glorious world around us with the whole panoply of fantastic things that we're surrounded by, the wonder of it all. But we scientists believe that it all springs from simple seeds. And what we try to do is to hack away at nature, looking for those simple seeds. And I once went to a lecture by a philosopher who said, and I won't name him, who said that in his view, the simplest explanation of the origin of the laws of nature was that God pushed every electron in the right direction all the time. Now, this seemed to me to be a bit profligate in when it comes down to explanations. So I set about wondering if there was a simpler explanation of the laws of nature, laws like the conservation of energy, that the amount of energy in the universe remains constant at a certain value, things like that. And I identified three principles. One is indolence, that you don't need to do anything at all. The second is anarchy, that you let anything go and hope to find a law emerging. And the third is ignorance, that you don't know something, but let's see what the consequences of ignorance are. And what I do in this book is to show that these three principles of indolence, anarchy, and ignorance account for, well, let me claim, all the laws of nature. And so if you haven't got anything going on that is guided, you don't need a guider.
We'll come to discussing it in a bit more depth in a moment's time. Just briefly, and we'll let Hugh respond to it, why overall do you believe God is a bad explanation?
Well, it's unnecessary.
Unnecessary.
Totally intellectually lazy explanation. I mean, anyone who says that this happens because God wills it or God caused it and so on is actually evading the real answer. The real answer lies in a mechanism which only science can actually identify.
Hugh, why do you disagree with Peter on that?
Well, I read your book, Peter, and saw what you wrote about simplicity. My perspective is that in science, things are never as simple as they seem. It's always more complicated. And I think really the principle is one of elegance and beauty, that really the right answer in science is that which shows the greatest elegance and beauty rather than simplicity. And even in something as simple as astrophysics, we always are always finding out what we thought was
the
simple
answer. What do you mean by elegance?
Elegance, meaning that, there's a certain, like look at the equations of physics. I mean, like Maxwell's equations.
They're very simple.
They're simple, but there's an
elegance
to it.
So why does elegance differ from simplicity?
Well, simplicity basically says that things aren't complicated, but they are complicated.
No, what simplicity does is to say that the root cause of things is simple, but the consequences can be quite extraordinarily complex.
Well, yeah, but what I saw in your book is the simplest answer will be more likely the right answer, but our experience in science is the opposite.
But you see, I think you should be very pleased with my approach, because if I can show that the laws of... One of the great problems of theology is how God actually interacted with whatever there was to cause the world, to bring it into being. You know, how does this thing outside space and time actually put its shoulder to the cosmos and get it moving? Now, what I do is if it provides a route for an explanation to that, because I show that nothing had to be done at all.
But
We'll come to this idea
that nothing had to be done. But just before we get to that, Hugh, why do you believe that God is a perfectly valid explanation? Obviously, Peter says intellectually lazy, not simple.
What I see in your book is this idea God is not necessary, but I could use that to discount everything. For example, I could say my wife of 40 years doesn't necessarily exist. I can come up with a scenario.
No, that's not.
Well, let me finish here.
Let's hear the end of that here. Yes.
Yeah, namely that the way we need to proceed in science is we look at competing models and say, okay, which of these different models is gaining more support as we continue to do scientific research? Not whether or not we can find some way of discounting something, because, I mean, we can't prove anything absolutely in science. What science does is show higher and higher probabilities for a particular model, but no model is ever complete. And so that's, I think, the way we need to proceed. You got a non-theistic model, you got a theistic model. As we continue to learn about nature, which one is gaining the greater support?
And just
and
before
evidence?
Peter comes back, why do you believe the theistic model, where God is behind the whole show, is gaining traction over the non-theistic model.
Why is that more elegant and why is it more simple?
Well, I look at five things: the origin of the universe, the origin of life, the exceptionalism of humanity, the fine-tuning argument, and the fact that the Bible has scientific predictive power.
No, it doesn't.
Well, I think it does. I mean,
what is the next great advance in science going to be?
Well, in one of my books, I basically make a whole bunch of predictions.
Okay, tell me one great advance in science that the Bible predicts and has not yet taken place.
Well, for example, I wrote an article pointing out we need to go back to the moon, find the Earth-transported soil. In that soil, we'll find the fossils of Earth's first life, which we'll never find here in the Earth because of Earth's geology, and we're going to be able to determine who got the origin of life model right, the theist or the non-theist, by looking at those pristine fossils that were created here 3.8 billion years ago.
And when will that happen?
Well, I think the Chinese are probably going to beat the Americans going back to the moon.
Yeah.
The Apollo mission was designed to find pristine lunar rocks.
And where in the Bible is it asserted that by going to the moon you will find these primordial fossils?
Well, the Bible gives credit to God for life here on planet Earth. And, you know, there's a non-theistic model for the origin of life. There's a theistic model.
Which is more elegant?
Which is more elegant? Well, I mean, look at the origin of life. I mean, that's something we've been researching now for over 60 years in some depth. Is the evidence we're finding origin of life research favoring the theistic model or the non-theistic model?
Yeah.
It is favoring the theistic model.
No, it isn't. I mean, the theistic model is just a lazy man's approach to explanation. It says, I can't think of a way that life can begin, so God must do it. What scientists do, and are doing extraordinarily successfully, is digging away intellectually into chemistry, into biology, into paleontology.
But they're not making progress, Peter.
Of course they're making progress.
Look, I go to Origin of Life research conferences. I hear what these gentlemen are saying
and
what they're publishing.
It's a terribly difficult problem, and we're not going to throw up our hands and say, oh, it's so difficult.
But I think Peter's view is that by positing God as the explanation, it's effectively throwing in the scientific towel.
No, it's throwing in the intellectual towel.
Well, the intellectual towel. Why for you, Hugh, is it valid to say, no, when you have a certain type of evidence, you should posit that there is a creative intelligence behind that, a divine intelligence in your view?
Yeah, I mean, just to discount God, I think, is being scientifically lazy. You need to look at both alternatives. Is God behind it or is... you know, God not behind it. To just simply forget about one, I think, is intellectually lazy. Let's look at both and see which way the evidence is going.
It's interesting to me, Peter, that at the beginning of your book you quote Francis Bacon.
Very clever man.
Very clever man, but of course a very devout Christian as well.
Yeah.
So were those, you know, 17th century scientists who, so many of them claimed a very devout Christian faith, all intellectually lazy, these people who birthed the modern science?
No, but they didn't have enough knowledge of science. Science was in its early days then. Science has only been going for, 400 years? Serious science, you know, since Galileo and Newton and so on. And the early scientists, including people like Michael Faraday in the 19th century, exemplars in the 20th century as well, simply didn't have the whole tapestry of science before them to see what extraordinary progress it had made.
But we do have modern...
And also, religious belief also depends upon cultural conditioning. And these people in the past were in environments which really supported religious views.
What do you make of that?
Well, I came from an opposite perspective. I was not raised in a Christian environment. I didn't know any Christians at all until I was 27. Met them, interestingly, at Caltech. That's where I first met serious believers. So I don't think I have that bias coming into this.
And what do you make of this view that essentially they simply didn't know enough about science, those who really began the birth of modern science, like Bacon and Faraday and others, that had they known enough, they would now be intellectually satisfied
atheists.
Well, you've
got people like James Clerk Maxwell. I mean, he's relatively recent, and yet he
was... Yeah, but he's relatively recent, but he's not recent. I mean, he's embedded in the 19th century. So it's recent science and advances in your own field of astrophysics and cosmology and...
A lot of my colleagues are believers. I mean, I've seen Nobel laureates come to faith in Christ who had an atheistic perspective.
Yes, I find that extraordinary. Why do you think that happens?
Because it got exposed to the evidence.
The evidence points in exactly the opposite direction.
Well, that's where we disagree. I see it strongly pointing in the theistic direction. I mean, look at Big Bang cosmology.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a strong reaction against the Big Bang in the early part of the 20th century because of its Christian implications.
Mm.
But now the evidence is overwhelming that the Big Bang model is correct. And therefore,
when we talk about the Big Bang, in your book, Peter, you talk about this idea, whether it's this universe or some previous incarnation of our universe, there was some point at which, as you put it, nothing rolled over into something.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting way of putting it. And you even say at the beginning of your book, in short, I want to show that nothing is the foundation of everything. It sounds very a contradiction in terms, obviously, and that's part of the reason I'm sure you put it that way. Hugh's view, I assume, Hugh, is that what we know of the way that space, time and matter all had its initiation in this Big Bang event is evidence that there is a cause for that must precede it, that must be beyond, in a sense, space and time.
Well, like the space-time theorems. There's now 30 different space-time theorems, and what I notice over the past 40 years, those theorems have become progressively more compelling, that there really is a beginning of space and time, and therefore a causal agent beyond space and time creates everything.
I believe with the first half of that sentence, I agree that it looks as though there was a beginning of time, which was, but I don't believe that it was caused, because you can't have a causal event unless you actually already have time.
Yeah, but you're presuming that...
It's very naive, in other words, to extrapolate our current understanding of causality, that this event precedes that, and so on.
Well, let's see what your response is to that.
Right back to the beginning, before there was time.
Well,
it's a very naive extrapolation.
You saw that in your book, Peter, that you presume that time and temporality are constrained to one dimension that can't be stopped or reversed. But the Christian perspective on this is that God has temporal capability independent of cosmic time. And therefore, there's opportunity.
Well, you can invent any properties of God that you want without evidence. But what?
But we do have evidence for the space-time theorems.
You have evidence for space-time theorems, but they don't point to the existence of God.
Well, they do point to something beyond time.
I think it's natural to ask what lit the blue touch paper. You know, where did everything come from?
I think it's naturally naive to ask, because if you don't have time, you don't have temporal ordering, so you do not have causality. And so the extrapolation of everyday causality, such as things going on around us now being caused by a preceding event, no longer applies.
Well, how do you, in that sense, then get from nothing to something?
Haven't a clue.
Right.
Absolutely haven't got a clue.
But you're appealing to the principle of causality, and that's basically your way of discounting God, is saying, well, if there's no time, there's no possibility of causality. But again, what you're positing is that you get causality without time. So in that point,
we both agree.
I'm
saying that time came into existence at the event that we call the creation, when, as you put it, in the way that I put it, when nothing rolled over into something.
But you're not willing to in any way give an explanation how that occurred.
Scientists don't know at
the
moment. Mm. But scientists are edging back to the beginning of time. And they're not going to give up now, shrug their shoulders and say, oh, Jesus,
but isn't as we approach that metaphysical barrier, though...
It's not metaphysical, it's scientific.
Well... isn't there a natural sense in which, as you approach a point at which you can no longer speak of time existing and space and matter and energy, they all seem to reach this infinitely dense moment in our
Yeah, but I want to talk about before
history.
That.
Well, exactly. And can we even speak of before that, if there is no time and so on?
Well, in another book that I wrote, which we're not actually talking today, called Creation Revisited, I did, in fact, explore possible ways of thinking scientifically about the event by which nothing turned into something. But you know, it's pure speculation, but it just shows that it is not outside the domain of human capability to construct thoughts about how it might happen.
In due course,
science will come and give an actual explanation.
So Peter is confident that there will be a naturalistic, mechanistic, scientific explanation for how nothing became something, Hugh. Just the last few minutes before we have to go to a break, explain why for you that's not going to happen from a purely naturalistic point of view. It has to involve God at some level.
Well, there's a limit to what we can explore through scientific observations. I mean, if God made 12 universes, we're only going to be able to explore the one that we're in. So there are limits. But what I notice about books being put up by atheists, not just yours, but books by Lawrence Krauss and others, is that their appeal is to that which we can't possibly know. Shouldn't we be basing our beliefs on what is measurable and testable, experiments and observations? And what I notice is...
So why don't you apply those criteria to theology?
I do.
No, you don't. Faith is the absence of evidence.
Well, for example, I mentioned earlier that what impressed me about the Bible is that it predicted the fundamental principles of Big Bang cosmology.
No, it doesn't.
Read the text.
I've read your book where you quote the text.
And yes.
I suppose at some point I actually read the Bible, or bits of it anyway. But what you've got is a group of old men sitting around several thousand years ago writing down fantasies.
But those fantasies proved to be correct.
No, they don't. What you do, you jump on a word and you say, I will stretch this word to include the inflationary universe and things like that. It's like saying, what would an analogy be?
Well, it's not just one word.
There's a passage in the Bible where Samson is bound, his hands are bound by cords. Hebrew word for I'm making this up. Hebrew word for cord is the same as string. String. That means string theory was anticipated in the Bible.
But that's not what I'm doing.
Yes, it is.
Let's allow Hugh to answer because Hugh.
Well, I think you're referring to the Bible texts about the expansion of the universe, and there are 11 different passages by 6 different authors. They use 3 different Hebrew verb forms to explain what this verb is all about. And it's clear it's speaking about the expansion of the universe. And it's not just me reading this into the text. Jewish scholars centuries ago saw the same thing in the biblical text long before we scientists discovered that the universe really is expanding.
I mean, a number of people have also pointed out, Hugh, that right there at the beginning of Genesis, God created, and that was significantly different from a number of the other pagan views of creation, which involved simply taking the existing elements and reordering them some way. There's a creation event, which for you is again an indication that...
That's why I rejected Hinduism and Confucianism, because they talk about God creating within space and time that eternally exists. The Bible says no. Time doesn't exist until God creates the universe.
We're going to go to a break, and we'll come back to you, Peter. I'm sure you're anxious to respond. We're talking about where did the laws of nature come from today, and we'll return to that topic as well in the course of today's edition of Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley. Hugh Ross and Peter Atkins are my guests on today's program. We'll give you the ways to get in touch with the show as well to give your thoughts on today's discussion in just a moment's time.
Believers and non-believers will all be helped, says Tim Keller, a wonderfully clear and accessible case for Christianity from a man who has hosted many of the world's most prominent skeptics and atheists, says Andrew Wilson. Beautifully written, brilliantly argued, will thrill and challenge, says R.T. Kendall. Unbelievable, the book by Justin Brierley. Download a free chapter and find out how it can help you make the case for Christ. Unbelievablebook.co.uk.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's programme. I'm Justin Brierley. Unbelievable is the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate every week. You can leave a comment underneath today's show if you go to the webpage premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Also welcome your feedback via our social media at UnbelievableJB for the Twitter account, facebook.com/unbelievableJB for our Facebook page, and you can email in as well, and we try and read as many emails at the end of each show as we can. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Today on the show, we're asking, where did the laws of nature come from? Hugh Ross and Peter Atkins join me. Hugh Ross is an astrophysicist and founder of Reasons to Believe, and his book, The Creator and the Cosmos, is now in its fourth edition, aiming to show why the latest advances in scientific research and discovery support the case for a creator. Peter Atkins has written essentially the opposite sort of book to this. His book, Conjuring the Universe, aims to show that the origins of the laws of nature and the universe are perfectly explicable without any need for God. In fact, as he puts it himself, I want to show that nothing is the foundation of everything. We've already been talking about that a little bit during the course of the show. As I mentioned, Hugh, as you mentioned yourself, others, popularizers in the scientific realm, have been talking about this in recent years. Lawrence Krauss, you mentioned, who's, again, a firm atheist in his outlook. And he wrote a book called A Universe from Nothing. What's wrong with scientists saying that the universe came from nothing? I mean, do they really mean nothing is the first question.
Right. And on reasons.org, you'll see a 16-page review I wrote of Lawrence Krauss's book, basically making a point. He talks about nine different kinds of nothing in his book, and each of his nothings is actually something. So quite distinct from the Christian view. I mean, Christianity also has this concept of creation ex nihilo, that the universe came out of nothing, and that's defined in Hebrews 11:3, how the universe that we can detect did not come from that which we can detect.
And so in that sense, the nothing being spoken of is nothing material.
Though nothing material.
God has always been present.
Whereas Lawrence Krauss's nothings are actually material.
Right.
Because quantum space-time fluctuations are not immaterial. I mean, we know that they can produce virtual particles, for example. Mm. And so, you know, where did the space-time quantum fluctuations come from?
So in a sense, Lawrence Krauss, in your view, didn't actually show the universe came from nothing. He showed that it came from something. And that still leaves the question, I suppose, of where did that something come from?
Exactly.
Right. What do you make of those attempts to sort of show?
Well, I agree entirely with Hugh.
Okay.
How about that?
I was not expecting it, but yes, I'll take that. Okay.
You had that in writing. I think what we have to do is to distinguish the emergence of this universe from maybe a pre-existing universe where laws of nature already exist, such as can give quantum fluctuations and such like. I'm not interested in that. I don't think that really gets to the heart of the problem. As you say, Hugh, and as God said before you, I presume, what you've really got to think about is absolute nothing.
Mm-hmm.
When how can absolute nothing, not just empty space-time, but nothing at all, no space, no time.
It's very hard to actually conceive that.
Yeah, you can't.
Because we always think in three dimensions, don't we?
Indeed.
Yes.
But you know, somehow or other, we've got to grasp that particular ungraspable
concept. Yes.
Because I think the real question of what happened at the creation is that absolutely nothing turning into what appears to be something.
And that's why I could see you, it's so difficult to get anywhere, because it's hard to conceive any kind of agency can exist, any kind of causal
indeed
nature could be there.
Yeah, but I'm not going to go down that route because I wrote about it in another book.
Mm.
I'm interested in the laws of nature.
Okay, well, take us on that journey then.
Not the incipience of the universe. But my, as well as indolence, anarchy, and
ignorance,
I also posit the possibility that nothing very much happened at the creation. I'd like to think that nothing at all happened, but that's really stretching unbelief too far for the time being. But nothing very much happens means that when absolutely nothing rolled over into being something, the properties of absolutely nothing were preserved.
Okay.
Okay. So that is the indolence part of it.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Now, there are very clever mathematical theorems due to the mathematician Eminetti, who showed that whenever you have a symmetry, in this case, the uniformity of absolutely nothing, then you have what's called a conservation law. That is a statement that a particular property is unchanging and unchanging for all time. So my view is that when absolutely nothing rolled over into being something, we can talk about that more in a moment, it preserved the uniformity of
absolutely nothing.
And so when we've actually got space-time, this is before the Big Bang, inherits the uniformity of absolutely nothing. Okay. Now, if you have uniform time, then according to this theorem by Eminetti, you have the conservation of energy. So suddenly you have got...
The first law of thermodynamics, effectively.
Yeah, not only that. I mean, the conservation of energy underlies the whole concept of causality and the existence of scientific explanation. So it's an extraordinarily foundational law of nature.
So there's this sense in which, for you, this law that we experience and see in the universe can somehow be tied back into this nothingness that preceded it.
Absolutely.
I mean, my question, first of all, and I'll let Hugh pitch in as well at this point, because this is stretching my brain a bit, but when you speak of the uniformity of nothing, simply by giving it a property, aren't you saying it is something?
That's a sort of...
Aren't we constantly running up against the problem we're having to describe something that is supposed to be nothing?
And you've got all sorts of problems as well. And I'm not going to try to disguise those problems.
Right.
You know, is there still nothing somewhere? And things like that. So let's ignore these.
Right. Much ado about nothing here, Hugh. Yeah. What's your view of
that's one of my chapter titles, by the way.
What's your view of Peter's whole thesis here, which is that you can get that the way that the properties and the laws of the universe exhibit themselves sort of somehow tie back into this state of nothingness?
Well, what I see Peter doing, you're attributing causality to nothing. You're attributing causality to the laws of physics.
No, I'm not.
And so, well, it seems pretty clear from your book that you're attributing, rather than attributing causality to a creator, you're saying that the laws have this property or nothing has this property. And I say, where do we have evidence that nothing produces something? I mean, it's speculation. And you admit that in your book, that it is all speculation. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying, well, really the way we got to go with our philosophical worldviews is base it on what we can actually learn through observations and experiments. And so I grant the speculations. I got speculations too, but I don't want to ground my beliefs on pure speculations.
But here's evidence for what I'm saying.
Well, I'm saying that I couldn't find any evidence.
Can I just pick you up before you come back, Peter? Just to expand that thought so it's clear, Hugh. Your view is that because Peter has no prior evidence of something coming from nothing, that's a speculation on his part, whereas you believe that there is evidence of things coming about because of agency, because of a cause, because of an intelligence. And so for you, that it's natural to assume that when we see everything coming into existence, that there is an intelligence behind it.
Well, the principle of cause and effect applies throughout all the sciences. We never see that violated. Why do we expect it to be violated at the cosmic creation event?
Because you cannot extrapolate from when there is time to when there is not time. That's the naivety of it. But that's the naivety of that kind of argument.
But you're compressing all temporality into cosmic time.
No, I'm not. I don't know what that means.
What do you mean?
For example, we know of three large dimensions of space and multiple small dimensions of space.
Well, we suspect there might be multiple dimensions.
Okay, but at least we know about the three large dimensions of space. Why can't we have more dimensions of time than what we see?
I've got an answer to that. I don't want to get too technical on this, but I think that let's go back to nothing again, because I think it's a fascinating subject.
Yes.
In a sense, we have still got nothing. And let me not go into technical
I'm just
details.
Tapping the table here, because as far as I can see, there appears to be a very physical universe we live in.
Yeah,
but you say, in actual fact...
You are deluded by appearances. what science does is to get beneath the appearances.
All right, explain how I'm being fooled.
Let me take an example, a simple example. Electric charge. Yes, there are positive charges. Yes, there are negative charges. Presumably, when there was absolutely nothing, there was no charge. Mm-hmm. So what we've got to do is to account for how electric charge was created, because we know observationally that there are positive and negative charges. But what we also know observationally from astrophysics is that the net charge, the total charge of the universe, is zero. If there was an imbalance of positive and negative charges, so strong is the electromagnetic force that it would blast the universe apart before gravity had a dime to keep it all together. So we know also that not only is there positive charge and negative charge, we know that there is exactly the same amount of positive charge and as there is of negative charge. Mm-hmm. So what happened at the creation was not the creation of charge, but the separation of no charge into its opposite.
Positive and negative.
Yeah. So yeah. I think that the more you look at the properties of the universe, you find that there is the opposite.
Yes.
So that when absolutely nothing rolled over into apparently being something, what it really did was to roll over from being nothing into its two opposites. Now, I think that is a much simpler thing for science in the future to explain than saying this was created and that was created.
Well, I mean, a couple of responses.
Yes,
number one...
And that's experimental evidence.
Well, I agree, but you've got anti-nothing and, you know, probably anti-particles and particles.
Yeah.
And they almost balance one another out. And it's just like having a bank account. I can have $10 of debt and $10 of assets. Yep. They cancel it to nothing. But guess what? That's not nothing. The debt is real. The assets are real. And we talk about everything being completely balanced. I don't think so.
I don't go for these analogies.
well, let me continue.
Let Hugh finish his thought here. Yes.
It looks like the universe is extremely symmetrical. But if you look at it at very great detail, you see it's slightly asymmetrical. Mm. I mean, there's a book written in the 1980s, The Left Hand of Creation, not written by a theist, written by a non-theist, who made the point that we see very slight imbalances. And those slight imbalances are critical to get life in the universe. So it's not like everything cancels completely
And that is part of the fine-tuning of
it's
the
part
universe.
Part of the fine-tuning,
in
right.
that sense, is these very, very specific imbalances
and just
are,
like
are part
the uniformity,
of what are needed.
The universe is uniform and homogeneous in large scales. And if that was perfectly uniform and homogeneous, there'd be no life. We need a slight departure from uniformity and homogeneity.
Yes, we're talking about cosmic homogeneity and uniformity, mm-hmm. and we're talking about the conservation of energy. Mm-hmm. So it's the big scale that we're talking about there, not the
big
microscale.
Scale, yeah, but
I agree that that time is not uniform locally because of distortion by mass and such like. But overall, I think just as there is no charge in the universe, there are plenty of other examples.
But is there no charge in the universe? I mean,
the net charge is zero,
says
Peter. Zero to 37 places of the decimal. I mean,
maybe we go to
60 places of the decimal, we'll find something. I mean, that's something that we physicists are actually looking at. Yes, it's uniform if we go to that many decimal places, but there's actually theories being proposed where they talk about, well, maybe there's actually some primordial magnetic fields. Now, so far, as I mentioned in my latest book, to 9 places of decimal, we don't think so. However, there are Big Bang creation models that actually posit that there might
But Peter seems to want to move from saying there's these two, aspects, the positive and negative forces in the universe, that if they were effectively cancel each other out, and therefore there is actually really nothing. But your view is, as you said in that bank account analogy, the fact there are two things that would cancel each other out does not mean there's nothing. There
exactly.
are two.
Exactly.
These are still physical forces.
Yeah, it's a
forces.
Philosophical they, error.
I mean,
but it's observational. I mean, but you challenged me to come up with experimental evidence. And what I'm putting onto the table in front of us is this experimental evidence. I'm quite happy for it to be explored to 1,000 decimal places.
Right.
That is very, very important.
Right.
But I don't think you're prepared to let God be explored to 1,000 decimal places.
Oh, I am. Definitely.
I mean, that, you see, there's no evidence for it.
Well, no, there's no evidence that you want to look at, but the evidence is there.
Well, I don't believe
and part of the evidence, in your view, Hugh, will move on from the creation event, the Big Bang, to the fine-tuning of the universe, which, as you see, has a lot of ink has been spilled and a lot of airwaves have been filled on this show
right.
debating that. It was actually one of your examples of kind of, because it's such a hard thing sometimes to imagine just how critically fine-tuned these particular forces are to allow for the emergence of life in the universe. You had a very good analogy for it in, I think, one of the early editions of Creator and the Cosmos, where you talked about piling pennies up to the moon can you just describe that, because that helps people, I think, to give a sense of what we're talking about here.
Well,
I'll just give you a few minutes to do that before Peter pitches.
I think we both agree that the fine-tuning evidence is strong, but where I think we need to go is, okay, if there's no God behind all this, we're going to eventually see the fine-tuning evidence decline. But if the fine-tuning evidence gets stronger and stronger from a Christian worldview perspective, that's really evidence for a Christian worldview. And so that's kind of what we're
documenting. Give us an example of the fine-tuning and talk about pennies being piled up on continents and how that demonstrates.
Well, for example, to have life possible in the universe has to have a certain cosmic mass density. It has to have a certain space energy density. And we can measure how fine-tuned it must be in order for there to be any possibility of life anywhere in the universe. And it's at a level of 1 part in 10 to the 122nd power. And that far exceeds the best example of human engineering fine-tuned design by about a factor of 10 to the 97 times, which means the one that was responsible for that fine-tuning design must be more intelligent, more knowledgeable, more creative and powerful than we human beings. I mean, fine-tuning is basically an analogy argument. We compare our capability for fine-tuning design, what we see in the universe, to make our existence possible. The other point we make is it looks like the fine-tuning evidence is much more persuasive if you want humans compared to if you want a bacterium.
Mm.
And particularly if you want a lot of humans on a planet with the technology where they can discover the great philosophical truths that lie behind the universe. That's where we see the greatest exponentiation of the fine-tuning evidence. And the fact that every month the fine-tuning evidence gets stronger than it was the month before.
I mean, one of the analogies I enjoyed was that given one of these forces that require to be so very specific in order for life to be able to develop in the universe to 1 part in 10 to the 37, and you compared it to covering the entire North American continent in dimes,
right,
all the way up to the moon, a height of about 239,000 miles. Next, pile dimes from here to the moon on a billion other continents the same size as North America. Paint one dime red and mix it into the billions of piles of dimes. Blindfold a friend and ask him to pick out the one dime, and those are the odds that they'll pick out the red dime at the odds of 10 to the 37.
And that's very conservative.
The
odds are much more remote.
I think that kind of helps people to slightly grasp just how precise these values had to be, given that it appears they could have taken other values, but that they have these very specific values that do allow for the emergence of life. Now, you're familiar with this argument, Peter.
Mm.
People like Hugh have been pressing that the atheist has to answer this problem. Why do we live in a universe which is so apparently fine-tuned for life to exist when it could have been otherwise?
Well,
is that not a very powerful argument for there being a creative intelligence behind it?
Let's unpick what's been said. First of all, God seems to have favoured rock more than life, as there is more rock in the universe than there is life. So he's made a peculiarly difficult selection of fundamental constants to get life. He could have chosen a different set of fundamental constants and avoided all the rock that there is. Think of it, all the rock was alive and worshipping him. He would be really satisfied. But, you know, that's rather a
We'll let Hugh come back to that in a moment, but yes, carry on.
So God favours rock rather than life.
Yes.
Secondly, We're basing our views on the kind of chemistry that we're familiar with. And different fundamental constants also lead to different properties of the elements. So maybe a slightly different choice of fundamental constants would mean that, say, aluminium or silicon would play the role of carbon much more satisfactorily than carbon currently does. We've no idea.
Mm.
Okay. But these are sort of superficial arguments.
Mm, mm.
They've got two more arguments.
Okay.
One is the possible argument I know Hugh is expecting me to roll out, that is that there's trillions of universes and that...
The multiverse hypothesis.
Yeah, yes. You have to be careful with that term, but let's call it multiverse. Because there are quantum mechanical illusions there as well, which I don't want to go into. But suppose there are trillions and trillions, in fact, 10 to the 1,000 raised to the 40 trillion universes, then it's not surprising that at least one of them has got this current
complex. We happen to have won the lottery of the multiverse in that sense.
We couldn't avoid winning it, as it were, because we're in it. So that's the possibility. And whether one could ever get experimental evidence for the existence of the multiverse.
And do you find that even as hypothetical as that theory is, it's more satisfactory than God as a possible explanation?
Because it involves no causality, and therefore no causa.
Right.
But the fourth, or whatever it is, argument is, I think you have to think about the foundations of what we're talking about. What's so special about life?
Okay.
Why are we making life such... a marvelous property. I agree it's extraordinary. I agree that through evolution, life, once it had emerged from the inorganic, has led to our current consciousness, and who knows what in the future. But what's so special about it?
Is it somehow slightly, in a sense... a bit egotistic of us to somehow...
Yes, it's cosmo-egotistical,
okay.
I think. So life is a jolly nice property of matter. But apart from that, why put it on a pedestal?
Let's start bringing up some of these. We've just got a couple of minutes. We might have to go into the next section to continue on them. But God seems to have preferred rocks to humans. So is the universe actually fine-tuned for rocks?
Well, if you don't have a lot of rocks, you're not going to get humans. I mean, the total size of the universe must be extraordinarily fine-tuned to get life anywhere in the universe. So it must have a lot of rocks in order for life to be possible, given the laws of physics. And you mentioned the multiverse. All multiverse models are subject to the space-time theorem, so you don't avoid the causality issue. And I notice you quote Leonard Susskind. I mean, he's an atheist like yourself, but he wrote a paper basically saying, we have to avoid, as atheists, the multiverse hypothesis. The reason why? It explains everything. And a model that explains everything explains nothing.
Like God.
Well, let me continue, because you'll see an analogy in the creator and the cosmos. Is if you're going to hypothesize a multiverse, you're going to have an infinite number of planets, like Earth. You're going to have an infinite number of trees. You're going to have birch trees. Birch trees peel white sheets of bark. You're going to have an infinite variety of universes. They're going to have birch trees that peel pieces of bark that are the size of A4 paper. They're going to fall on soil that's got random chemicals in it that make markings on it, which means that all the papers published by all the scientists in the world didn't come from their minds. They came from the multiverse. The multiverse did it.
I've never heard such nonsense.
The point he's making, I think, is that in a multiverse where everything that can happen will happen. You've got everything
You see, I told you to be very cautious in your use of the term. It could be that all those other billions, trillions, what, quadrillions of universes have no life in.
Well,
agreed, but if you're going to appeal to an actual infinity, you're actually going to wind up with an infinite number that have life in them.
Yeah, that's quite possible.
I mean, that's my whole point. It literally explains
everything.
The strange sort of...
Sorry, you accuse me of having a theory which explains everything, and you're sitting there proposing that God can do absolutely everything. So why can't I say that God is nonsense, as much nonsense as my nonsense is?
Well, because, you know, God's got a mind.
No, he hasn't. He's outside space and time. He doesn't have a mind. He's not some sort of figure with a brain
and
a
mind. But I think, you know, you had an Anglican background. I mean, in Anglican theology, there's this idea that everything we see in the universe testifies that there's a mind behind it. I mean, where did our mind come from?
It came from evolution.
Well, there again, you're violating the principle of cause and effect in the sense you're
trying. No, I'm
not. Yeah, well, you are in this sense. Everything we measure in science tells us that you get the lesser from the greater, not the other way around.
That is nonsense, absolute nonsense. You're now alluding to the second law of thermodynamics, I think. And it shows the typical misunderstanding of that extraordinarily wonderful law. And maybe we do that in the next session.
Well, maybe we will. Let's go to a quick break. And we'll just have 10 minutes or so to wrap up what's been a very lively conversation on the programme today between Hugh Ross and Peter Atkins. They're my guests, debating where did the laws of nature come from. We're looking at the universe and whether God or nothing is the best explanation at some level for it. Continue our conversation in just a moment's time here on the show that aims to get you thinking unbelievable.
Premier Christianity Magazine. In this month's issue,
find out how the church reacted to the Grenfell Tower fire in our exclusive interview with Bishop Graham Tomlin. Plus, is hidden disappointment killing the church? We look at how to handle this difficult emotion and discover Christian views on gender and women's ministry in the church. Plus 5 miraculous stories, news, reviews and more. Out now in the June edition.
For your free copy, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable. And we've got some really exciting stuff going on Unbelievable at the moment, because we're about to launch our big conversation series. Starts on Saturday, the 9th of June. And I'll be sitting down with some of the biggest thinkers in the Christian and atheist world to talk about science, faith, philosophy, and what it means to be human. It begins with Jordan B. Peterson and atheist Susan Blackmore talking about whether we need God to make sense of life. They're talking about the psychology of religion next week here on the radio show and podcast, but also in video format. And that's where I'd really like you to go and watch these programs as we release them. You can sign up to our brand new Unbelievable newsletter, which will give you all the big conversation videos, articles, and resources in one place. Go and sign up at thebigconversation.com. Show. We're also launching a brand new Unbelievable app for mobile and tablet devices. There's the newly launched Unbelievable YouTube channel where you can watch all of the big conversation video series too as we release videos. After we've heard from Jordan Peterson and Susan Blackmore, further episodes of the big conversation will include Steven Pinker, Nick Spencer, Daniel Dennett, Keith Ward, Derren Brown and Reverend Richard Coles, Peter Singer and Andy Bannister, and a special live audience edition of the show when I'll be sitting down with Professor John Lennox and Professor Michael Roos, and you're invited to that on Wednesday, the 18th of July. That'll be a live edition of The Big Conversation with a live audience. So if you'd like more information on all of that, including the live edition of the show, go to thebigconversation.show where you can find more details, and do sign up there for the brand new Unbelievable newsletter, which will keep you informed with all the extra resources, videos, and bonus content. That's thebigconversation.show. Well, coming up a little later on in the program, we're going to be hearing from two unbelievable listeners who joined me recently, Kira and Wendy, and their reactions to today's programme, because they've been sitting in on this conversation between Peter Atkins and Hugh Ross today. I'll also be sharing some really interesting conversion stories that have come in via email as well. Straight after Unbelievable, between 4 and 5, you can hear The Profile. I'm sitting down with Lucy Pepiat. She's the principal of a theological college here in the UK. She'll be talking about her own life story, her conversion, and her own approach to what St. Paul has to say about women in the book of 1 Corinthians. In fact, this has really changed my mind, actually, on what Paul actually said about women in 1 Corinthians. You might want to listen to that yourself. You can also find The Profile as a podcast wherever you get podcasts from. That's The Profile with Lucy Pepiat, straight after Unbelievable. Don't forget, you can get in touch about anything you hear on today's programme too. Email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, facebook.com/unbelievablejb for the Facebook page, and Twitter is @unbelievablejb too. And you might also want to check out our new YouTube channel too. On YouTube, just look for Unbelievable with a question mark and find some of the debates and interviews we've been putting up on the channel over the last few weeks.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, we're into the final part of today's edition of the programme, a scientific and philosophical and theological debate. But Peter Atkins doesn't like theology. Not a great fan of philosophy, I get a feeling, but really likes science. He's our guest today, former professor of physical chemistry at the University of Oxford. He's an atheist, well-known voice in the science and faith debate. And his latest book, Conjuring the Universe, aiming to show that the origins of the laws of nature in the universe are explicable without any need for God. In fact, they're based quite literally on nothing. Hugh Ross is our other guest. He's our Christian guest, president of Reasons to Believe. Astrophysics was his route into coming to faith, and his book, The Creator and the Cosmos, now in its fourth edition, continues to aim to show why the latest advances in scientific discovery support the case for a creator and the truth of Christianity. Again, you can find out more about Hugh and the team at reasons.org. Go to the Oxford University Press website for more about Peter Atkins' latest book. So I'll come back to you first of all, Peter, here, because you were wanting to press into something Hugh had raised, which for you appeared to him being appealing to the second law of thermodynamics, which is this idea that that everything tends towards a state of, if you like, dispersal or chaos.
I mean, this is another example.
The law of entropy, as it's sometimes
called. I saw that in Hugh's book, he gives another example of pouncing on a word and then pretending that it actually accounts for the whole of 21st century science. This word that I saw was decay. And you said, you pounced on the word and you said, okay, that means that the ancients had already discovered thermodynamics or had anticipated it, because you know, the second law of thermodynamics is all about decay. But you know, these old guys were surrounded by dead camels. They were surrounded by dead dogs, corpses, and decaying meat and so on. That's what they meant by decay. They didn't mean by decay the very clever, subtle dispersal of the chaotic dispersal.
What about the Apostle Paul?
Well, give us the example that you're thinking of then.
Well, here. Romans 8, it says the entire creation is subject to a pervasive law of decay.
Yeah, that's because
so
there
are dead animals
everywhere. Yes, it was. And dead plants, dead everything.
But he used the word universe.
Yes, but what he meant by universe is what he could see around him.
Well, but I suppose the whole point is that if Hugh believes that there's predictive power, there's a sort of some prophetic almost element to this. It may well be that Peter didn't have in mind, obviously, the laws of the universe at the point he was standing, but nevertheless, his words seem very apposite the nature of the idea of the second law of thermodynamics,
that we live
in a universe that is constantly decaying.
That is typical of the Bible and of Hugh's approach to it, that it is written in elastic. The words can be stretched to mean anything.
I see.
Not really. I mean, I would make that accusation against the Quran, for example, or against the Hindu Vedas.
Yeah.
But the Bible is really specific, and you've got
all it says, as you quote it, is that the universe is everything in the universe decays. What the second law of thermodynamics does is to explore the consequences of that and to show that there are local abatements of chaos.
Which I would agree.
And driven by decay elsewhere.
Right.
And nowhere is that subtlety alluded to in the Bible. The second law shows that structures can emerge. Paul didn't say that because things can emerge. All he saw was dead camels.
Your view is, I mean, we're not going to get agreement on this, obviously. And you obviously do believe that what Paul said in Romans is applicable to a scientific view. But your view is that what we experience now is simply a pocket of order in an overall system that tends towards disorder.
You could put
that
it
sense,
like that.
In that sense, Peter,
yes.
that we are, you know.
Local structures can emerge from decay elsewhere.
But you do face up to the fact that, you know, if we simply go on a purely naturalistic view of where the universe is headed, we are headed towards the so-called heat death of the universe at some point, where there will be all of matter and energy will be so
dispersed that no life can possibly exist in.
It's a sort conceivable
future. It's a kind of a cold, sterile void.
It's not a necessary future, but it's a conceivable future.
What I find interesting is that, in a sense, the Christian story, as far as I see it, acknowledges that if that's the future, actually God's going to do something about it, going to redeem the universe in some way, so that that not is... Is that your view, Hugh,
yes.
That's...
That's cosmic wishful thinking, isn't it?
I don't think so.
Well, clearly it is. What's the evidence for God doing something in 400 trillion years' time?
Well, I think he's going to do it a lot faster than 400 trillion years. But the whole point is, when we look at the fine-tuning argument, we see that it's most enhanced in the context of redemptive theology, which tells us that there's going to be a divine rescue of humanity that's going to save us from the heat death of the universe.
What nonsense.
Well, again, Peter, look at the evidence.
There's no evidence for that at all. It's simple wishful
Look at the fine-tuning evidence.
No, but I've already demolished that.
I don't think so. I mean,
what you said in your book about fine-tuning, actually, Peter, is that no one has a clue as yet why these values have their current and, for us, serendipitous value.
Yes.
I mean, Hugh's view is simply that best explanation is that there is an intelligent mind behind the universe.
That's just lazy.
It's not lazy in the sense that if we continue to do the research, which way does the trend go? I mean, you can't call that laziness. Well, that's being diligent.
Well, the more science progresses, the less need it has of God.
It's the other way around. I mean, look at the origin of life. We were talking about that earlier. What we see at Origin of Life Research Conferences is that every successive conference, they have a lesser case for a naturalistic
explanation.
There's
more problems that they're running into.
They're running into more intractable problems as they continue to learn more about the origin of life.
It's extraordinarily difficult, but we're not going to just throw up our hands and say, God,
but the fact that it's getting more difficult.
We have got as many difficulties as there are, we have possible explanations. It's just that we don't know the early conditions on Earth sufficiently well.
What I'm interested to know, though, Peter, is I think at one level, some people might accuse you of being so committed to atheism that you'd never be willing to countenance any evidence that might lend support to a creator behind the universe. So I'm just interested, what sort of evidence could science or the physical universe present to you that would make you think, actually, that is evidence that there's a mind behind this?
I find that... a very difficult question. If I were looking in the Bible for evidence, heaven forbid, I would expect to see maybe increase in entropy is equal to Q reversible divided by temperature. And that is,
if there was literally an equation in the Bible,
the Bible, rather than all this wishy-washy, elastic writing that it pervades.
Right. So if there was something like that they discovered in the Bible,
then I'd think it was probably a forgery.
Well, exactly. The problem is, would it actually make you? I mean, is there anything from, any kind of evidence in the universe that could make, I mean, if the stars lined up to spell, Peter, please believe in me. It's about time.
I'd put it down to madness.
You put it down so
to personal madness,
right?
Yeah.
Sounds like, Peter, that there's no evidence that would persuade you away from atheism.
Well, to be honest, I think that's probably the case.
In that sense, do you even have an evidence-based view if you're actually committed to atheism a priori?
Well, I'm predicting that there will be no such evidence. That's not quite the same thing as being committed to it a priori. I can't.
But you said there's no evidence that would persuade you otherwise.
I think it's much more likely that I would have gone mad than such evidence would have been provided.
Right. So in principle, it's impossible to ever persuade you that God exists.
I didn't quite say that, but.
Well, what would persuade you?
I can't conceive of... I suppose even if I died and was confronted with St. Peter saying, welcome to heaven, I'd probably think I was dreaming.
Would you? That leads me on to my next question.
If I were dead...
Would you want it to be true?
Do
you want God to exist in any shape or form? Would you be pleasantly surprised if you woke up on the other side of death
and found a life of eternal bliss? course, there's a play by Bernard Shaw, isn't there? Man and, is it Man and Superman?
Where, yes,
where
maybe.
Heaven is found to be so boring that they ask to go down to hell for a bit of fun.
Well, what I mean, it feels fair to ask you the same question, but in your case, what would make you lose your belief in God and Christianity?
Well, I don't think any belief system is really of any value if it can't be proven wrong. How can you be right if there's no way you can be proven wrong? And so, for example, if I were confronted
No, but I have to interrupt there. I'm not being proved wrong. I'm successively being proved right. That's what I'm after.
Yeah, but you can't conceive any way in which you could be proved wrong. That's the it's unfalsifiable in that sense, your system. Isn't that fair to say from what you've said?
Not quite. I think I take a positive view that progressive proof of being right is not quite the same as
being unfalsifiable.
Unfalsifiable.
Yeah, but okay. From what I understand, your position is unfalsifiable, but I would argue mine is. So, for example, if
good,
I was...
I'm sure it is.
Well, it's falsifiable.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, a belief system isn't worth anything if it's not falsifiable.
I disagree, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, if you were to show me incontrovertible evidence that the universe had no beginning, that would be catastrophic to my Christian faith. If you could show me
but
that
I
we humans...
had a beginning. So that doesn't... I'm not concerned to do that.
Okay. Well, likewise, if we were to show that we humans were not exceptional compared to all life, that would be catastrophic to my Christian faith.
But we are exceptional in the sense that we can reflect upon the nature of the world and invent the concept of God.
This is evidence for what the Bible declares. The Bible declares that we are exceptional. Likewise, the resurrection.
Yeah,
if the resurrection
we'll have
Jesus,
you converted by the end of the show, by the sounds of it.
Yeah, we might.
It's been really fun. Thank you both. We are going to have to, unfortunately, draw it to a close, and it would have been fun to have carried on. But it was interesting, I think, to get to that foundational level of what we're talking about when we come to evidence and to hear both of your perspectives on that. Thank you both for being with me on the programme. I hope you'll come back, Peter, maybe when the next book is out. I know you continue to write in the whole area of science and the history of science and so on. I wish you all the very best in this universe that ultimately is made from nothing, came from nowhere and presumably is heading towards a similar state.
Not to convert anyone, but I just want to let people understand what they should go on to understand.
Mm. Hugh, thanks for coming in as well to
You're
share
welcome.
On the Creator and the Cosmos. So make sure to check out the links from today's show. You can find out more about Hugh and Reasons to Believe at reasons.org and links there, of course, to the Creator and the Cosmos 4th edition. And Peter Atkin's new book, Conjuring the Universe, are now available from Oxford University Press. There are links from today's show. If you want to find out more there, do go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. But for the moment, Hugh and Peter, thanks for being with me on the show today.
My pleasure.
My pleasure too.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, it's real fun to be joined in the studio just now by two unbelievable listeners who have flown in all the way from the USA, and they came in for Unbelievable, the conference recently. It's been great to get to know them a little bit because you have both sat in on a recording of Unbelievable.
Yes.
Kira and Wendy, welcome along.
Hi, Justin.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. I always enjoy meeting people who've come a long way to see the show and to enjoy the conference and that kind of thing. So it just worked out well that you could come into studio and see the way
things
were.
We're so excited. Thank you for having us. Yes.
You're a self-described kind of apologetics geek yourself,
yes.
aren't you, Kira?
Wendy,
where are you from originally?
Originally from Tennessee.
Okay. Hence the
yes.
southern drawl.
Yeah.
I've met
my husband in South Carolina.
Okay.
He is the... he actually was not... a strong Christian when I met him, and one of our first dates was the Alpha program.
Course.
Yes, yeah. The Alpha course.
Oh, right. Fantastic.
At the Episcopal Church I was attending.
Oh, fantastic.
Time.
So was that a little bit of a journey towards him?
Yes,
finding
absolutely.
A grounding for his faith.
Yes.
Great.
He was a biology major, and yeah.
And how did you bump into the show, Wendy, yourself?
My husband told me about it.
Ah,
so
okay.
I've been listening a couple of years, I think, maybe a little longer.
Fantastic, yeah. Fantastic. Kira, you're from California. Yourself.
Yes, yeah, that's where I live now. Yeah.
Right, and so what made you bump into the show yourself?
Well, I'm a podcast nerd, so I love podcasts, and I was kind of out of podcasts, so I asked Wendy if she knew of anything interesting, preferably something on theology or apologetics, because I was kind of on a kick at that time, and she said, oh, I know the perfect podcast. You have to listen to Unbelievable. It's really great. It's British, so you get to hear everybody talking cool accents, and it's all very polite. And so I went back and I found the first episode that I played. That was last October. So I've heard every single episode.
Oh, wow. I love it. Great. Now, look, you've been sitting in on the discussion we've had between Peter Atkins and Hugh Ross. What did you make of that, guys?
That was amazing.
It was brilliant. Yeah. It was a brilliant discussion.
It was. We had so much. There was a moment there where Dr. Atkins, the skeptic, talked about the rocks and how, there was so much rock. And why, if there was a God, then why don't the rocks?
Why aren't they worshiping?
Why aren't they worshiping God? And we looked at each other and we were like, they do.
I'm pretty sure that Jesus said something about that.
I almost thought it was intentional.
I didn't even think of that.
We looked at each other immediately.
Oh, I love it.
I almost took it right to church right up in that second.
That's
so funny. Kira, you also do some writing for a blog. Tell us about that.
I do. I am a blogger. I write politics and culture for one of the largest conservative blogs in the United States, redstate.com. You can look me up. I mean, I used to freelance too, so I write all over. But
what kind of things do you write on for them?
Typically politics and then cultural issues. So anything just the way that social aspects are moving. I'm sure you have heard a lot about our president and what's happening there. So there's plenty to talk about. So I generally write about things like that. Yeah. Cool.
And what are you doing when you're not visiting Unbelievable in the UK, Wendy?
I'm an artist. I have a background in graphic design. And the last decade, it's mostly been sculpting.
Fantastic.
Yeah, fine art. So.
Well, it's been really lovely to meet you both, because it's always fun to meet folk who have come over, especially for Unbelievable. And I hope you enjoyed your experience of sitting in.
We did. Thank you so much for inviting us. It was such a pleasure as fans. And it was wonderful.
Well, bless you guys for coming. And I'm so pleased you discovered the podcast, along with many other people who listen in the USA. And we're hoping to get out to the USA before too long for an Unbelievable conference there
as well. Yes, you need to come out there.
Watch this space. Watch this space. Fantastic. Kira, Wendy, thanks for being with me.
Thanks, Justin.
Thank you.
And I'd be interested to hear what you thought about today's program. You can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk or send me your thoughts via social media at UnbelievableJB for the Twitter account, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB if you want to get in touch via the Facebook page, where I also post regularly articles, blogs, interesting videos and bits and pieces. Indeed, the latest Big Conversation promo video is available pinned to the top of the Unbelievable Facebook page. Thanks to Ruben Isaac, who got in touch via Facebook, to say, while looking into tough questions, I found plenty of YouTube videos of each side presenting their case. It became difficult to get answers to the specific questions each side would bring up. Because of this, I was looking for a good, fair debate show between Christians and non-Christians and stumbled upon your show a couple of months ago. I love it. I've been telling my friends about it here in Dallas, Texas. Though it's given me some things to think about, overall, it has strengthened my faith. I'm a Christian. Keep on doing what you're doing. Thanks, Ruben, and I'm glad you're enjoying the show. Also had this fascinating email in from Megan. No, not that Megan, the bride of Prince Harry. No, this is a different Megan who's emailing in from the USA. She got in touch initially to say, as a former militant atheist recently turned Christian, I have to say how immensely I enjoy your podcast. I've been listening for a couple of years now, find it very entertaining. In particular, I have to echo the majority of listeners who write in remarking on how good a moderator you are. I wish you could run a class where other podcast hosts could learn from you. I can hardly believe I went most of my life not even giving the theistic or Christian side of the story a chance, as it's so rich with thoughtful and convincing arguments. Thanks for all the work you do to provide this content. It's really helped me solidify my faith. I'm personally very much drawn to the mystical tradition in Christianity. So I got back in touch with Megan because I always like hearing people's stories of how they came to faith. And she was happy to provide it. She says, I grew up in a pretty agnostic household. We just never talked about it, although I think both of my parents have private spiritual sides. I was always considered the smart one. And as I delved into the sciences in high school, I became quite the militant atheist. I read probably every Richard Dawkins book. I reveled in my identity as a free thinker and hyper-rationalist. I can see in retrospect that it really fueled my ego identity as the brilliant scientist. The catalyst that changed everything, though I didn't really recognise it at the time, was when I fell in love with a boy, Mike, in my grade. We were best friends, both too shy to say that we liked each other, but we started having the most wonderful debates and conversations, since we disagreed about nearly everything. What made him different from most people was how deeply he listened during these conversations. It was like everything I said was of the utmost importance to him, and he took my arguments very seriously. He was a much more courteous debater than myself. Interesting how similar those conversations were to the ones you have on Unbelievable. Maybe that's why I like the show so much. Anyway, Mike showed me a perspective on religion that I was totally oblivious to, and I respected him so deeply that the first shift in my thinking occurred. I was no longer outright antagonistic toward religion. And maybe there was some beauty to it, even if I didn't believe it. Maybe one could be both smart and religious. And I was so attracted to Mike's heart that I started to realise that I'd sacrificed much of my own heart to cold reasoning. Fast forward about 5 years, I went through college, was still identifying as an atheist, but at least I wasn't reading Dawkins anymore. I'd started to find his brand of atheism repellent. I had a health crisis at the beginning of my graduate programme. When I was told by doctors that I'd have to take medication my whole life and that I might have trouble conceiving someday, I absolutely refused to accept it. I dived into research on alternative health modalities, ancestral nutrition, holistic lifestyle practices. I started implementing these types of practices and, lo and behold, reversed my supposedly incurable condition. I became incredibly passionate about the topic, started going even deeper, particularly into mind-body medicine. It didn't take me long to realise that the most important piece I was missing was the spiritual piece. And the success of these alternative health strategies made me so starkly aware of how little I knew and how wrong I'd been about at least some things. What else was I wrong about? Remembering my profound conversations with Mike, I started looking into the side of the religion story I'd never really given a chance in my high school days, the theistic story, and then specifically the Christian story. When I started looking into the evidence, I was shocked at how convincing it was, and this is from someone who knew every atheist argument in the book by heart. Even more importantly, it just felt right. Far beyond the machinations of my rational mind, my heart resonated with Christ and his message. I decided then and there I would follow him forever. Now I'm a scientist, just graduated a couple of days ago with my PhD in physical chemistry, and when I look at the world, all I can see is God's hand in everything. I'm so grateful for the journey I've been on and for the obstacles that God put in my way, which ended up being my salvation. I love spending my days learning even more about Christianity from resources like your show. Thank you very much, Megan, for sharing that. Got a really interesting, very different conversion story as well that also came into the show quite recently. This is from Dale, who was in touch a little while ago via email, but said he wanted to get in touch to let you know the good news that after years of researching, I've finally come to the point that I think Christianity is probably true, and so I'm finally in a position to commit myself to Christ. Out of respect, I just wanted to say thank you for all the hard work with the show. It's been an invaluable resource in my own search as I use the podcast to get familiar with some of the arguments and scholars on both sides of various issues many times. So I wanted to let you know how much I appreciated it and how it's played a role in my own research and ultimately concluding Christianity is true. Now, this is where the email gets really interesting. The way Dale came to faith. Listen to this. My decision was based on using a simplified version of Bayes' theorem to calculate both the positive and negative evidences in relation to the truth of Christianity, and entailed my having to come up with an 11-premise deductive argument based on converting the skeptical argument from confusion into one that can be used to argue for the truth of Christianity. In the end, I was able to demonstrate that Christianity is more probable than not, 53.14% to 55.1% in favour of Christianity, which factored in negative evidences at a 95% degree of certainty that Christianity is false, and positive evidences from the Shroud of Turin, my own properly basic belief via the witness of the Holy Spirit, a vindication argument, and also the historical evidence for the resurrection appearance to the 12. If you're interested for me to send any info on this stuff, I'd be more than happy to share and hear what your own feedback on my approach or research is. Remembering I'm a layman and not one of the experts you're no doubt used to by now. Okay, thank you very. So I said thank you very much, Dale, for this, because it's just one of the most fascinating conversion stories I've ever heard, in terms of it just appearing to be purely some kind of rational, deductive argument that, that led Dale to the point where he was convinced that Christianity was true. And I did sort of bring that up and say, do you feel like this is somewhat too abstract, a way of kind of coming to faith? And Dale was kind enough to get back in touch to say that I hope in some way my unique way of putting the evidences together will be of help to others as well. That said, I have to admit it has been a drawback in my search, in that I was only really interested in Christianity as a sort of abstraction, as you say. Now that my intellectual doubts have been satisfied, I'm trying to adjust to the emotional or spiritual aspects as well in order to establish a real connection with Jesus. And I understand there have been other Christians that you've been involved in that journey with. So thank you very much. Just found that such an interesting, I've never really heard a conversion story quite like that, Dale, but thank you for emailing in, and look forward to hearing more about your journey as it continues. Perhaps you've got an interesting story, and we have people who go in both directions who listen to the Unbelievable show. It's not one-way traffic necessarily, but I always enjoy hearing people's journeys on this program. If you'd like to email again, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. We'll be making sure to include more of your feedback in future editions of the program. But for the moment, thanks for being with me on today's show, and do come back next week for the start of The Big Conversation.
You're unbelievable.
Yes, I'll be joined by the cultural phenomenon that is Jordan B. Peterson, author of the book 12 Rules for Life, and just at the moment one of the most celebrated and controversial thinkers out there. He's going to be in conversation with atheist psychologist Susan Blackmore on the question of whether we need God to make sense of life. And you'll be able to watch this on video too. Do make sure to subscribe to the Big Conversation video series with all the updates, extra resources, bonus content and more at the website, thebigconversation.show. Look forward to kicking off that special series this time next week. Until then, have a good week. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Podbean, or any other podcasting software, and find out more about our other Premier podcasts at premier.org.uk/podcasts.